I know this is difficult for you. It must feel as if you're helping me argue a case you don't agree with, but all I'm asking for is the facts. You think I'm hell-bent on putting Annette and Naldo Chapa behind bars? Well, that may be so, but no fact has ever had an agenda. Facts are just facts. They're neutral, and they are all we have to go on, so we need to hear them. Are you going to tell the viewers at home, or shall I?
M.T.
Women in Annette Chapa's position almost always say they feel conflicted. They're so happy to have their baby, obviously, that's a joyful thing. But at the same time, they know that baby wouldn't be there if they hadn't lost the baby that didn't make it. They feel guilty. They ask if it's okay to be happy about the new baby, whether celebrating its arrival is indirectly celebrating their deceased baby's death. I always tell them that of course that's not the case at all, that of course they must celebrate.
BJ.
Did Annette Chapa say anything of this sort after Melody was born? You were there, a first-hand witness. Were Annette and Naldo overcome with joy when Melody made it into this world safe and sound?
M.T.
I'm sure they were, yes.
B.J.
You're sure, huh? Did they express this joy that you're so positive was in their hearts? Verbally, I mean, or with their body language?
M.T.
No, but not everybody is the same.
B.J.
What did Annette Chapa say to you when Melody was born, Mallory?
M.T.
She said it was a tragedy that Emery wasn't there with them. She felt Emery should have been there to meet her little sister, and she wished that she could have been.
B.J.
She said those words, Emery should be here?
M.T.
Yes.
B.J.
She said that, knowing that if Emery had been there, Melody would not have been?
M.T.
That makes it sound... She didn't mean that. She just meant...
B.J.
Did Annette ever say to you what, by your own admission, almost every woman in her position says, that she was overjoyed to have Melody but also felt guilty? Did she ever ask you, as so many mothers have over the years, if it was wrong for her to be happy about Melody's arrival, knowing it wouldn't have been possible if Emery hadn't died? Did Annette or Naldo ever say anything like that to you?
M.T.
No.
B.J.
All the same, it came up in conversation, didn't it? Tell us how.
M.T.
I visited the Chapas at their home when Melody was 3 weeks old. Naldo seemed okay. Annette didn't. She was quiet and subdued. I was concerned. I thought maybe it was the kind of guilt we've been talking about.
B.J.
So, although she'd never given you any reason to think she felt guilty, you wondered if Annette was punishing herself for being happy about Melody's arrival, in case that happiness could be construed indirectly as an acceptance of Emery's death?
M.T.
I wondered, yes. Like I said, that feeling is just so universal among women who've...
B.J.
So, did you ask Annette if this was the case?
M.T.
Yes.
B.J.
And what did she say? How did she reply?
M.T.
Look, women who've just had babies say all kinds of strange and scary things. It's really common. And immediately afterward, as Annette did, they burst into tears and tell you they don't really mean it.
B.J.
We should probably mention that this behavior is known among self-proclaimed experts as ugly coping or coping ugly. For those unfamiliar with the term, it means dealing with a traumatic incident in a way that's inconsistent with socially acceptable behavior. It was coined by Dr. George Bonanno of Columbia University, and it's now regularly used to defend murderers who are guilty as sin, so thank you for that, Dr. Bonanno. It was used by Jose Baez to defend Casey Anthony, who went out partying and got herself a new tattoo saying La Bella Vita when she was supposedly desperately worried about her missing daughter, Kaylee Marie. Mallory, I'll be honest. I don't have any more time for this ugly coping theory now than I did back in 2009. And you haven't answered my question. What did Annette Chapa say when you asked her if she felt horribly guilty to be so thrilled to have her beautiful new baby, Melody? I'm sure you're wishing now that you'd never told me what she said, but you did, and it's my duty to get this out there, so...
M.T.
She said it was the other way around. She said she felt as if by allowing Melody to be born, she'd colluded in Emery's death. As if by having Melody, she'd somehow made Emery's death final and irreversible, and... Sometimes this made her feel she hated Melody and wished she'd never been born, but...
B.J.
And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Annette Chapa wished that her beautiful little daughter Melody had never been born. The woman is a monster. Mallory Tondini, thank you for joining us here on Justice with Bonnie. Next up, I'll be talking to the CHOPA's lawyer, Lexi Waldman, and asking her, is there anybody, any monster out there who she would not defend? Does she have no morals at all? See you after the break.
Chapter 7, October 11th, 2017. Can I really stop now, without knowing how the Melody CHOPA story ends? You promised yourself you would. Yes, I did, but that was before I knew how much I'd want to know what happened after Bonnie Juno interviewed Mallory Tondini. Surely her theories alone weren't enough to make detectives arrest Annette and Naldo CHOPA and charge them with the murder of their daughter. There's still the last part of the overview to read. That's where the answers to my new questions will be. A quick glance shows me that part 3 is short. I have to read it. Then I'll stop. Then I'll concentrate on my own problems.
Melody CHOPA, the full story, an overview. The Murder of Melody CHOPA, Part 3. Bonnie Juno, Mallory Tondini, and a Change of Direction. After Bonnie Juno's live interview with Mallory Tondini on Justice with Bonnie on September 2, 2010, and in spite of Tondini's repeated insistence on that show that she did not believe Annette and Naldo CHOPA had harmed Melody, the official investigation into the disappearance of Melody CHOPA took a different direction. Annette and Naldo CHOPA were cross-examined again, and their home was searched more thoroughly than it had been previously. Once again, nothing was found. This time, however, Detective Larry Biedman decided to take it one step further and also search Melody's parents' workplaces. This, incredibly, had not been done before, no doubt because of the circumstantial evidence mounting against Christy Reville. At the back of a cupboard in Annette CHOPA's office, Biedman and his colleagues found several garbage bags filled with books that were waiting to go to a charity auction. At the bottom of one, they found some dead blowflies and larvae, the same species found in Melody's school bag. As stated earlier, these flies are commonly found on and near dead bodies, which led detectives to conclude that body parts belonging to a deceased person must have been inside the garbage bag at some point. Laboratory analysis found that there was blood all over the inside of the bag. Forensic testing confirmed the blood was Melody's. In Naldo CHOPA's office, a shirt belonging to Melody and covered with her blood was found in a holdall that Naldo claimed he'd forgotten was there and hadn't touched for several years. Melody's parents' protestations of their own innocence convinced nobody. They faced multiple charges, though both continue to protest their innocence to this day. In June 2013, after hiring and firing three different legal teams, they were finally found guilty of the murder of their daughter, Melody CHOPA, and were later sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. No charges were ever brought against Jeff and Christy Reville. They turned down a lucrative book deal and never spoke publicly about the case. In 2014, they set up a children's charity that they still run, the Melody CHOPA Foundation. Many books have been written about this case and many questions asked. Most of these remain unanswered and perhaps always will. Who snatched Melody? Annette and Naldo CHOPA were both provably elsewhere, so did they send someone else to abduct their daughter from the school parking lot, having set up solid alibis for themselves? Christy Reville admitted shortly after the CHOPAs were charged with murder that she did not, as she first claimed, take Melody all the way to the school playground. Eager to get to the home of Victor Sutar and running slightly late, she waved goodbye to Melody in the parking lot and then drove away. The walk from the parking lot to the playground is 75 yards, and there are parents and children walking there in large numbers at that time in the morning. Did someone grab Melody and bundle her into their car without anybody noticing? It seems unlikely, yet what other conclusion can we draw? It has been suggested that if a third party acting for the CHOPAs murdered Melody and disposed of her body, it's unlikely that the garbage bag and the holdall containing incriminating evidence would have found their way into the offices of Annette and Naldo CHOPA. This is only one of the many contradictions the case has thrown up. Bonnie Juno has stated that she believes Annette and Naldo Chapa asked whomever they hired to do the hit job on their daughter to bring them each a souvenir of the murder, and that this would explain the evidence found in their offices. Naldo got the bloodstained school shirt Melody was wearing on the day she died, and Annette got goodness knows what. I can't imagine she'd have been satisfied with 5 dead flies, so I'm guessing there was a garment in that sack when she first got it. I have no idea where that garment is now, but I suspect she moved it or disposed of it after seeing Mallory Tondini on my show. She knew the net was closing in and tried to ditch the evidence. Since the Chapas seem unlikely ever to admit their guilt, we will probably never find out for certain why they murdered their daughter or had her murdered by a third party. Bonnie Juno has always maintained they did it because, ultimately, they could not forgive Melody for not being Emery, the daughter they lost. On the Andrew Runcie show, Juno said, "Let me tell you something about abusive parents, Andrew. Most of them claim to love their children, and never more so than when those children are sitting quietly with neat hair and clothes, silently quaking with fear in case they do something wrong. Perfectly behaved children, sleeping children, they're not a challenge. They don't make an abusive parent want to hit out. Same goes for dead children. I firmly believe Annette and Naldo Chapa worshipped Emery only because she never lived, never caused them even one second of stress. She was their lost angel, a perfect memory. Melody, on the other hand, was a real flesh-and-blood person with needs and wants. Like all children, she must have had tantrums, broken things, cried, not been able to sleep some nights. Good, loving parents take all that in stride. But the Chapas, as we all now know, were not good and loving. They were monsters, monsters who killed their own beautiful daughter to punish her for the death of her sister. They're sick and wicked, and I hope they rot." Neither Annette nor Naldo Chapa has yet revealed the whereabouts of Melody's body. So far, it has not been found.
The sound of the doorbell reminds me that there's a world outside my head, beyond the story of Melody Chapa. It must be room service, here to collect my breakfast tray. By the time I get to the door, I've decided I don't like Bonnie Juno, but I agree with her. Annette and Naldo Chapa are guilty. Of what? Melody's alive, remember? You met her. Also, if Christy Revel's totally innocent, why did she have blood all over her arm? Nate Appleyard and the petrol station man both saw it. It's not the room service waiter at the door. It's Taryn Fry, in white linen culottes, a navy blouse with a pattern of pink blotches, white sandals and a powder pink sun hat. Her eyes are hidden behind dark glasses. "You get over your fit of the vapors," she asks me. Behind her, there's a club car and driver waiting. "Come on, we've got things to do. I'm tired of waiting and wondering. Let's find Rihanna. See if she's gotten those cops back here yet. Grab your room key, let's go." She claps her hands together. I open my mouth to protest, but she's turned her back on me and is marching back to the club car. "Wait!" I yell and run back inside to get my handbag and casita key. "Go, driver," Taryn says once I'm in the club car. Then, to me, "So, are we good? You and me?" Is she asking if I'm still annoyed? "Last night you asked why I didn't tell you sooner that Zell and me are on the third floor." "It's because I have some pride. When you said the room Rihanna sent you to was on the third floor, I thought, hey, what a coincidence, we're on the third floor too. I could have said it, but it's the kind of thing only a dick would say, like, can you believe the weather we're having? Or, haven't you grown since I last saw you? So I didn't say it." "Fair enough. I'm sorry if I seemed freaked out. Listen, I've worked something out. Last night, when I was standing in the corridor talking to you outside your room, you were in the doorway and Zelly walked up behind you and went into the bathroom, didn't she? She went through a door on the right from where I was standing, I mean. So? The room where I met the man and the girl was the opposite. The bathroom was through a door on the left after you walked in." "Nice," Taryn sounds impressed. "That's a useful way to narrow it down. I've made progress, too. I've been asking around, and I've got the names of the guests in the other three rooms." "How did you manage that?" "Charm my breakfast waiter," she grins. "They have a type list each morning of who they expect to show up for breakfast. And, right beside their name, there's their room number. Taryn reaches into her shirt pocket and pulls out a small white envelope embossed with the Swallowtail logo.
Wanna hear?
Okay, room 322. Carson Snyder and Yegor Lepchik. Both men. A gay couple. The waiter I spoke to, Oscar, he knows who they are. He's served them a few times, says they seem young, fun, regular guests. So that rules them out. Room 324. Robert and Hope Katz. Drew a blank with Oscar. He can't recall ever meeting them and wouldn't know them by sight. Room 323. Suzanne Schillinger. A young businesswoman traveling alone, here for a conference in Scottsdale. Oscar knows who she is. Says she's a little aloof and always on her laptop, obsessed with whatever dreary job she's wasting her life on. He said that. What? No, not the bitchy part. That's my take. So, anyway, I think it's pretty clear.
What's clear?
It's gotta be room 324. Robert and Hope Katz.
That's your father and daughter. Those are the names Melody and her minder, or whoever he is, are traveling under. Bet your bottom dollar.
Open the door to their room, and the bathroom will be on the left. Taryn shakes her head and chuckles. I can't wait for Bonnie Juno to get a hold of this new chapter in the story. I knew she was wrong about the choppers. Can't tell you how many times I said, but there's still no body to anyone who'd listen. Question is, will Juno ever admit it?
Maybe her crime-busting sidekick, the Lord, will help her to solve this new phase of the mystery and do a better job this time. I'm sure he will. It seems to matter to the Lord that the ratings of justice with Bonnie should remain high.
Our club car passes the tennis courts. They're all occupied, balls flying through the air and thwacking against rackets. How can people do it in this heat? The gay couple, Carson somebody and his partner, I start to say, not sure what I want to ask. Why did my mind snag on them in particular? Then my brain catches up. Yesterday, I overheard you say something to Zelly about the best choice always being a gay man. I wasn't deliberately eavesdropping. Who cares if you were? Jeez, Cara, you're so English. It must be horrible. I must make sure never to visit your country. I wouldn't fit in. What did you mean by that comment? What were you talking about? Taryn stares at me.
Interesting question. You got some kind of conspiracy theory brewing?
According to Bonnie Juno, Annette Charper said in an email that Jeff Revel was gay.
Did she?
Taryn shrugs. I was talking about hiring staff for my shop. I interviewed a few people last week. Haven't made any offers yet because no one was quite right. No gay men applied at all. That's what Zelly and I were talking about. I was saying, what I want is a gay man, not a straight man, and not a straight woman.
Why not?
The women always want to knock off early and come in late if they've got kids. And if they don't have kids, they'll be trying to have kids. Or if they're older, they'll want time off to babysit grandkids. I can do without all that. And straight men? They have wives who want them to get home early, or drop the kids at school in the morning, or order a fondue set, or fix the screen door. And even though these guys don't want to do any of that shit, they can't say no to their wives because they're a bunch of pussies.
What about gay women?
Two wombs instead of one? No thanks. Per couple, I mean, Taryn clarifies. Oh, driver? Can we swing by the studio zone on the way? Might as well pick up Zelly from her art class. We're a bit early, but the less time she spends with dying of cancer, Haley, the better, far as I'm concerned.
My shock must show on my face because Taryn says,
What? Oh, you think I'm cruel? You think it's nice for Haley to have a friend? Look, I'm a mom. I don't want Zelly to get close to this girl and then be all cut up when she dies and start brooding about her own mortality. No one I cared about died till I was over 40. That's the way it should be. I mean, I lost my mother at 22, but let's just say that was a death with some powerful upsides. Who is this woman? What am I doing with her?
This art class? Taryn chatters on, oblivious. Other day, they did portraits. They do a different art thing every day. Spray paint, cubism, watercolors, you name it. Anyway, they needed models, and what do you know? Every art class parent loses a morning of their vacation, but that's fine. Guess what Zelly called the picture she painted of me? It was actually pretty good, apart from the title. Irreversible Decline. Taryn laughs. She sounds more proud than annoyed. Nothing as simple as portrait of mom for my Zelly. And you know what they're doing today? Sculpture. Fucking sculpture. I am so not okay with art that takes away floor space. Same goes for shelf space, table space. She seems to have lost interest in what she's saying, which is lucky, since I can't think of a suitable response. Annette Chopper thinks Jeff revels gay, she says suddenly. Are you sure? I never heard that. I got it from the internet. Maybe it's not true. Did you happen to come across Ingrid Allwood's ingenious theory during the course of your online investigations? I'm about to say yes when I realize that's wrong. I didn't. I was on the point of reading it, but I got distracted by seeing Lilith McNair's name, and then I clicked on another link and forgot all about it. Tell me, I say. Allwood claimed, and I believe she's still standing by her hypothesis, that neither the Chopers nor the Revels could have abducted and killed Melody without the help of the other couple. She thinks the four of them were all in on it, and their aim was to get away with it by planting evidence to incriminate all of them, all four. They knew it'd be impossible to destroy all the evidence, or leave none, but if each couple could make it look as if the other had tried to frame them, while also making sure there was other stuff to suggest each couple couldn't have done it, maybe they could all get acquitted. Or not even charged in the first place. Personally, I don't buy it. I can't see an elaborate, hey guys, let's all frame ourselves, plan ever attracting any support. Here we are. The club car stops outside a brown bungalow-style building, long and rectangular, with a red door along the bottom of which someone, a previous art class no doubt, has painted a row of yellow and blue flowers with green stalks. Wait here, says Taryn. I'll run in and grab Zelly, then we'll go find Rihanna. I'll be 5 seconds. Normally when people say that, they mean they'll be at least 10 minutes, but Taryn is as good as her word. She and Zelly emerge from the building almost immediately. They're arguing about Haley. She's sick, Mother. I can do a painting for you any time. Zelly doesn't say hello to me or acknowledge my presence. You're so selfish. Did you not hear me say she's getting worse? But I'm a florist, and it's a painting of some flowers, Taryn complains. I mean, do I need to spell it out? Yeah, well, Haley, despite not being a florist, loves it too, so just drop it. I try not to picture Taryn scrapping with a terminally ill child for a painting. Did the art tutor have to intervene? Apart from anything else, how was there time for it to happen? How much unpleasantness could Taryn pack into 4 seconds? Probably quite a lot. She sighs, defeated. Hotel reception, please, driver, she says. Wait, I say. I've seen something. Someone in the distance. It can't be. This is wrong. Wrong person. Wrong place. Oh my God. It is. It's him. I jump out of the club car and run, ignoring Taryn's cries of protest. I keep telling myself I must be wrong until there's no doubt any more, until I'm standing in front of him, out of breath and sweating. Hi. He smiles as if there's nothing at all remarkable about us both being here and bumping into each other. It's really him. My husband. Patrick. Chapter 8. October 11th, 2017. I blink, inhale, exhale, repeat, blink, breathe, blink, breathe. But it makes no difference. Patrick is still here.
You could try looking a bit pleased to see me, he says with a wry smile. I ran to the airport like the romantic hero of a cheesy movie, determined to find my one true love.
He's flown for 10 hours to get here, and he doesn't seem angry that I disappeared without warning. I should be a little bit happy about all of this.
No, Patrick's sticking with the jokey tone, but I can see he's hurt. He must have expected me to burst into tears and throw my arms around him. All right, then. How about some grudging admiration for my investigative skills? I successfully and single-handedly tracked you down.
I can't bring myself to look at him.
With great cunning and aplomb, he tries again, hopefully.
I need him to stop talking. The discomfort and shock I felt when I first saw him is turning into a swelling fury. If only I could yell at him, my rage might dissolve. But I've never been able to let rip in that way. I'd rather make secret plans and disappear to another continent than tell anyone how I feel. You're a joke, Kara. A mess. How did you find me? I managed to say. Much easier than, I don't care what you want. I'm not getting rid of the baby.
Aha! Patrick grins. You didn't leave many clues. Hardly any, in fact. But you forgot one major thing. You forgot to delete your browsing history on the computer.
I wouldn't have known how to do that, even if I'd thought of it. I never considered that he might ignore my clearly expressed need to be alone for a while. What do you expect? You've got children. Responsibilities.
Ah, well, you see, if you'd been a more tech-savvy fugitive, you might have got away with it. I could see you'd been looking at various resorts and hotels in America, and the one you'd looked at most often and most recently was this one. And then there was the location, Camelback Mountain. You don't usually run away from home, so there must have been some sort of catalyst, a straw that broke the camel's back. I wondered if Camelback Mountain might have appealed to you for that reason.
So you just ditched the kids, booked a flight and came?
Well, I checked you were here first. I rang up. They wouldn't tell me at first, said they couldn't give out confidential blah blah, so I waited. Rang back an hour later and asked to be put through to your room, as if I knew you were staying here. They fell for that. I'm getting no reply from Mrs. Burroughs' casita, sir. I tricked the truth out of them, like an ingenious double agent.
The kids hate staying at your mum's. What about school?
What about it? Broadly speaking, I'm in favour of it. Finally, Patrick drops the comedian act. You ran away from home, Kara, without saying why or talking to me or anything. Would you have preferred me to shrug and say, ah, well, that was fun while it lasted, no point trying to get her back, better just accept it?
I didn't run away. I left. I'm not a child or a possession that can be retrieved against my will. My note made it clear I was coming back. I told you exactly when, the 24th of October.
So I was meant to just sit at home and wait, with no clue what was going on in your mind or where you were? Come on. What was I supposed to tell Jess and Ollie? Kara, what's wrong? What's the problem? Sorry, that sounds flippant. I don't mean it to. What I mean is, I want to make everything okay, but you're going to have to give me a clue.
Is it about... He stops. You can't bring yourself to say the baby, can you?
Well, it's not a baby yet, is it?
Isn't it?
I don't know. It wasn't when you first told me. You said it was no bigger than an olive.
Patrick sighs. Do you desperately want to keep it?
I mean... Okay, fine.
That's not what you said before. You, Jess and Ollie all made your feelings clear. None of you want the inconvenience. You all think our family's exactly the right size.
We made our feelings clear because you asked us. You kept asking us. So we told you. And you nodded and listened and encouraged us to be honest, share all our reservations and anxieties. And then you punish us by leaving home. I mean, unless this is about something else altogether.
You've no idea, have you?
Right,
Patrick nods. I see the first stirrings of anger on his face.
Because you haven't told me. Why don't you tell me?
Breathe, Kara. I could answer him. So easily the words are almost bursting out of my mouth. But I won't. We shouldn't be having this conversation now, here. It was supposed to happen on Tuesday the 24th of October, at home. That's when I wanted it to happen. What I want ought to matter, and not only to me. I emailed you, I say. You ignored my email. You could have replied and asked me anything you wanted to know. You didn't have to...
I didn't reply because I was already on my way here. I wanted to talk face to face. Is that so wrong?
Maybe it isn't. All I know is that if I can't have these 2 weeks to myself, to think, to work out who I am and what I want, then I can't have any time ever. This is my one chance. I told you when I'd be back. You should have respected that.
Sorry, but that's crap, Kara. You made a unilateral decision to disappear. All right, you had your reasons. Ones you won't tell me, but having done that, you can't accuse me of imposing my terms against your will. At least I'm talking to you. You never asked me. Not once. If I wanted this baby. I'm too angry and miserable to hold it in any more. You never asked me how I felt. Hours we spent talking about it. Me asking you and the kids what you thought, how you felt. Listening carefully to everything you said, all your reasons, the expense and the stress, and where would the baby's bedroom be? And we can't move house. It's too much hassle. All of that. And not one of you asked me even once, even indirectly, in any way at all, what I wanted to do. You all treated me like someone who was chairing an important meeting, someone whose own opinions and feelings weren't relevant enough to be mentioned. I assumed you were undecided. I'm sorry I didn't ask directly, but for God's sake, Kara, we talked about it for hours. Jess, Ollie and I all said what we thought, and you could have done the same. Why didn't you? Wouldn't that have been the sensible thing to do, instead of waiting for us to ask you, so that you could go off in a huff when we didn't? Hang on. Is that why you asked us over and over again, to remind us that we'd neglected to ask you? That's screwed up. Why not be more straightforward? All right, I will. I'd like you to leave. I'd like you to go back to England, rescue our children from your mother's overheated house, and take them back home, so that they can start going to school again. I'll be back on the 24th of October, as I said in my note, and we'll talk then. Patrick tries to speak, but I raise a hand to stop him. If you do this one thing for me, it's very likely that I'll come back and admit you're at least partly right. I'll never think it's okay that you forgot to ask me how I felt about finding myself unexpectedly pregnant, but yes, I was weak and a coward, and I handled it all completely wrong. Then, once I've apologized for being rubbish, and you've apologized for being rubbish, we can talk about the baby and how we feel about it. And I am keeping it, whether you want it or not. I won't get rid of my own baby. Kara, that's fine by me. And the kids. Look, wait. I haven't finished. I'm glad you think it's fine, but I don't want to, I can't discuss it now. You need to go home without saying another word and leave me here so that I won't always think you ruined something important I tried to do. I hope that makes sense. Kara, Patrick smiles as if I've said something sweet and amusing. I'm not going home without you. Please try to. Then I'll go. I'll leave. Without looking back, I run as fast as I can away from him. Kara! He calls out. He's not following me. Yet. He will, once he sees I'm not going to turn around like a well-trained boomerang and hurry obediently back to him. I run and run. Where am I going? Back to my casita? No. To the car park. I've got my bag with me. With the hire car's keys inside it. My passport and wallet. My ultrasound scan of the baby. That's all I need. I have to get right away from Swallowtail if Patrick won't leave. I have to win. Kara. The voice, not my husband's, is quiet and comes from behind me. I turn to see who it is. A hand shoots out in front of my face, startling me. Something yellow moves fast, presses hard against my nose and mouth. I try to call out, but I can't make a sound.
I heard something on the radio the other day. A guest on a talk show was asked for her favorite word. She said, holidays. I thought that was cheating. I couldn't believe she liked the word for its own sake, for the sound of the vowels and consonants and the way they harmonize together. Holidays is a nice-sounding word, but if it meant incredibly hard work, would she still have chosen it? I don't have a favorite word. Only two least favorites. Parents and family. I can write them easily enough, but I hate saying them. And most of all, I hate hearing them when I'm not prepared. But if holidays meant parents, and parents meant ice cream, and ice cream meant family, I think I'd feel differently about all these words. So, it turns out I had no right to think the woman on the radio was doing it wrong. it's too hard to separate the word from its meaning. When I first made up the name, Kind Smiles, for the only people who ever smiled at me, I was 6 years old. I'm 14 now, but I can't stop thinking of them that way. I must have been pretty naive when I was a little kid. I thought I could protect myself from my mother by not looking at her. It worked sometimes, but not always. One time I was sitting on the carpet surrounded by the toys and dolls I liked to play with. At the other end of the room, my parents were watching TV. On this particular day, one of my teddy bears, Rosa, had a secret she wouldn't tell anyone. The others were crowding around her, begging to know, saying true friends don't keep secrets from one another. I was explaining, in Rosa's voice, that this was such an important secret that she couldn't possibly share it. Not yet. I hadn't decided what the secret would turn out to be. I was looking forward to deciding later. My mother turned the TV off suddenly. Having never shown any interest in my games before, she got up out of her chair, walked over to where I was sitting, and picked up Poggy. Moving him around as she spoke for him, she said,
"You're not being fair, Rosa. Keeping secrets is wrong. You know that. We don't keep secrets in our family."
I couldn't bear to see my mother's pale pink fingernails digging into Poggy's sides. The voice was all wrong, too. Nothing like the one I'd invented for him. I wanted to scream. Let him go. But I couldn't. I was also worried about what would happen to Rosa. But Poggy was my main concern. If anything happened to him, I'd die. My father did and said nothing. Just watched.
"Tell Poggy your secret, Rosa,"
said my mother. "I don't know what it is," I told her in my own voice. "I haven't made up my mind."
"Is that so?" she said.
She dropped Poggy, snatched Rosa from my hand, and took her out of the room, into the kitchen. I heard a drawer open. My father stared at the switched-off TV. A minute or so later, my mother came back in, having cut Rosa into furry brown pieces. She dropped them in my lap. "That's better," she said. "No more secrets."
Part 2. Chapter 9. October 11th, 2017. Taryn Fry drummed her bare feet against the floor, listening to the buzzing silence at the other end of the line. "Come on, pick up. Today, ideally, lazy assholes." Zelly would be back from her after-lunch nap on a massage table soon, to fill their hotel room with the smell of alpine arnica oil, her favorite scent of all the ones on offer in the spa, despite the vastly superior ginger root also being available, and this phone call was one Taryn didn't want her to overhear. Though, come to think of it, maybe that was only delaying the problem, because there was no way Taryn could do what she planned to do without Zelly finding out eventually. No way at all. "Ma'am?" A woman again, but a different one. Hopefully she'd be more helpful than the last one. "Can I clarify, was it Detective Sanders or Detective Pretty you wanted to speak to?" Taryn made a puzzled face at the phone. She'd never heard either name before. "Tall and blonde, Detective Bryce Sanders. Short and dark, Detective Oren Pretty." The woman chuckled. "We call him Starsky and Hutch." "How thrilling," said Taryn flatly. "Look, I don't know either of these two guys. Why are you asking me about them?" "They're the two detectives who were at Swallowtail. I was told you wanted to speak to one of them." "Either of them. I don't care what color hair, just put one of them on the phone. Can you do that?" "Oh, I see. Right, I'm with you. Putting you back on hold while I go track them down." "Great," Taryn muttered to nobody. The hotel room door opened, then banged shut a few seconds later. "I'm back," Zelly called out. She appeared a few seconds later in a waft of alpine arnica. That was the least effort massage I've ever had. It was a man. He applied no pressure at all, basically just distributed dripped oil over my back and smeared it around a bit. Taryn put the phone down. If she wanted to tell Zelly about her plan, she would tell her, not have her overhear without knowing the score. Who are you calling? Taryn deflected her with a question. Did you see Kara Burrows on your way to or from the spa? No, why? She's not by the pool or in her casita or anywhere, far as I can tell. Zelly rolled her eyes. Right, so because you don't know her exact whereabouts, you've decided she's disappeared? Please tell me you weren't just on the phone to the police. Seriously, Mom? You could be right. Maybe she'll show up. Taryn decided to leave it until tomorrow to call the police again. What were those detectives' names? She'd forgotten them already. Dark and Blonde, Starsky and Hutch. They were more likely to listen after a whole night had passed. It is harder to claim someone's missing when you've seen them that same morning. And if reporting Kara's absence from Swallowtail could wait until tomorrow, so could her plan. The other thing. Was Taryn really going to do it? Yes, she was. Why not? What harm could it do?
I open my eyes and I know something's lost. Something important. Did I lose it? Is it my fault? The baby? Please, not the baby. No, that's not what's gone. It's time. A whole chunk of it is missing. I don't know how much. My hair has fallen in front of my eyes. I can't see properly. Only flashes of yellow and green checked fabric and cheap dark wood. This isn't my casita. And I can't push my hair out of the way because my hands won't move. I gasp, convulsed by a wave of shock that turns the blood in my veins to ice. Someone's tied my wrists together. My ankles, too. A man's voice said my name. Just my first name. Just Kara. Dread rises inside me until it's a lead weight on my tongue, stopping me from calling for help. What do I know? What can I work out? I've been unconscious. My head feels heavy and sore at the bottom, as if someone poured liquid metal into it that's now turning solid. I'm bathed in sweat, my clothes damp and twisted, my throat scratchy and dry. I need water. The thirst isn't full-on pain yet, but it soon will be. The yellow cloth. That must be how he knocked me out. With chlorophyll. No, chloroform. Chlorophyll has something to do with trees. Didn't anyone see anything? Patrick. But no, he couldn't have seen. I'd already run too far when it happened. I left him behind. If only I'd stayed with him, kept talking. Is anybody looking for me yet? Did the man carrying me, unconscious, to his car in his arms? Somehow he must have got me here without... The thought dead ends in my mind. Here. What does that mean? Where is here? It's nowhere I recognize. I shake my head to shift my hair out of the way so I can see properly. I'm in a room, about 15 by 10 feet at a rough guess. There are dark wood kitchen cabinets of various sizes, some with windows showing glasses, mugs and plates. Others are solid fake wood veneer, stained and chipped. No one has paid this place any decorative attention for a long time. It has an abandoned feel to it. No, don't think that. You're not abandoned. Panicking is the worst, most stupid thing I could do. I'll get out of here. Soon someone, the man who brought me here, will come in, untie me, and explain what's going on. I need to keep thinking, keep trying to work things out, arm myself with as much information as I can, so that when he comes back, I'll be ready for him. Whoever the hell he is. His voice. Was it one I recognized? The detective I saw at the spa? The man from the wrong hotel room Rihanna sent me to? Was it Mason, who gave me the iPad, or Dane Williamson, the resort manager? Maybe it was someone I've never met but only read about. Jeff Revel? Victor Sutar? I try to remember other men from the Melody Charper story and can't think of any. Can't be Naldo Charper. He's in prison. It's got to be about her. Melody, nothing in my life would cause this to happen to me, not even running away from home, abandoning my family without warning. Why didn't I mind my own business, keep my mouth shut about what I saw in that hotel room? Kara Burrows, is she safe? She might have been, if only she'd said nothing. If I'm not safe, my baby isn't either. Without a mother, Ollie and Jess aren't safe. Patrick's not enough. My kids need me. They need me home. I have to get back to them, whatever it takes. Think, Kara, find a way out. How far from Swallowtail am I? From the fullness of my bladder, I'm guessing I was unconscious at least an hour or two, maybe three or four. It's still light outside. Wait, the windows. They're wrong. Yellow and green check curtains. But that's not the problem. It's the corners of the windows. They're curved, not sharp. Not right angles. They remind me of train windows. This whole room is wrong. What is it? A kitchen? Then why is there a bed at the far end? Yellow with small pink flowers, bedspread, matching pillowcases. I'm lying on a caramel-coloured leather sofa that's more of a bench. It's hard as stone, it's leather back embedded in the wall next to one of the two doors. Kitchen, living room and bedroom. Everything's all stuffed in together. There's one chair, a dirty orange and brown monstrosity, and far too many cupboards. But the cooking area, hob oven, work surface, is laughably small. Like a miniature. Not quite doll's house size, but almost. Wedged between the chair and the wall, there's a coffee table with books on it. The one on top of the pile, the only one I can see, is called The Devil Dragon Pilot, by someone called Lawrence A. Colby. The only thing on the walls is a television attached to a bracket and a calendar that's still on August's page. Above the grid for the days of the month, there's a cartoon drawing of a white kitten sitting in a pink and blue striped teacup, winking and waving. I shuffle my body to the left so that I can see over the edge of the sofa. The floor's linoleum, more grey than brown, and even more obviously fake than the kitchen cupboard doors. To cover it up, an understandable urge, someone's put down a bobbly navy blue rug that looks like an oversized bath mat. All I can see through the windows is bright blue sky, wires, an electricity pylon. No trees or tall buildings. If I could stand up and see out of the windows, but with my hands and feet tied, that's impossible. Someone wanted to make absolutely certain I'd stay where they left me. Fuck! I say out loud. Fuck! A tidal wave of fear seizes me, then sends me crashing down. All I want is my family. Please! How could I have done this? I wanted so badly to get away from home, and now I might never get back there. All the problems I thought I had before, they were nothing. Minor irritations. I was too blind to see it. Too lucky. I have to try to get up on my feet. Swinging my legs, I propel my top half forward. I land badly, clumsy and unbalanced, with a twist of my right ankle, and fall to the floor. It feels like less than a second before I fall to the floor. Wincing, I rotate my foot to see if I've sprained anything. I don't think I have. It hurts, but not enough. I can't see a way to stand up now that I'm lying on the floor. It was easier from the leather sofa. I could swing my legs over and downward. From this position, I can't see how I'd do it. Unless I can somehow get onto my knees and then... The sound of scraping freezes the unfinished thought in my mind. What was that? A key in the door? There's a loud, clanking thud, like something banging against a metal sheet. The floor shakes beneath me. Metal. I know what this is. I'm in a trailer. Whatever they're called, a mobile home. That's why all the different rooms are stuffed in together. I hear the sound of a key again, and the door nearest to me opens. A man walks in, wearing a check shirt and denim shorts, dusty brown lace-up boots. Kara Burrows, he says. He looks terrible. Grey-faced, tense, exhausted. Of course it's him. I should have known. Please let me go, I say in a firm, clear voice. Let me go, and I promise I won't say anything. I won't tell anyone. Kara, I'm sorry, he says. I'm so sorry. And he starts to cry.
Chapter 10. October 12, 2017.
Hey, isn't it your birthday next week?
Said Detective Bryce Sanders as he pulled the car out of the Paradise Valley Police Station's parking lot.
Tuesday, isn't it? Wednesday,
said Detective Orwin Pretty.
Althea buying you dinner someplace special? I don't know. We'll do something, I guess, but no plans yet. You should celebrate your birthday, OP. Make plans, bud. You only live once.
Three teenage boys were standing on the sidewalk up ahead. One was right on the edge with his back to the street. He looked as if he might fall into the moving traffic at any moment. Pretty thought about reaching over to beep the horn. On the other hand, he wasn't driving, so not his problem.
Unless you're Melody Choppa,
Sanders added as an afterthought.
What? You only live once unless you're Melody Choppa? If you're Melody Choppa, you get murdered, and then suddenly 7 years later you're alive again and hanging out at a spa resort.
Sanders laughed.
How much do you think a night in a place like that costs? More than I could afford, that's for sure. You'd be okay married to a woman of means. Waste of money. We're lucky. We get to go there for free. Maybe today we can fit in a swim. I'm sure our resort manager friend, Mr. Dane Williamson, wouldn't say no. Today? We're going back there?
Sanders nodded.
Did that woman call again? Rihanna? Nope. Then why? I don't know why we bothered going the first time. That old lady's one blade shy of a sharp edge. You sure about that, bud? Because I gotta tell you, there's been two more sightings.
Pretty didn't react. It was all bullshit. He knew it, and Sanders knew it. Still, he didn't care. Might as well spend the day at Swallowtail as anywhere else.
And guess what?
Sanders tried again to arouse his interest.
One of the women who saw Melody alive has disappeared. A Mrs. Cara Burrows from England. Then, after she vanished into thin air, there was a third sighting of Melody, this time by a Mrs. Taryn Fry. She's the one who called me. Oh, and Rihanna Briggs? According to Taryn Fry, there's no sign of her either. I'm telling you, OP, some shit's going down at that resort. I don't know what, but some weird shit, that's for sure. Some kind of group hysteria, most likely.
Pretty yawned. He didn't want to talk about Melody Choppa. If she was alive, great. If she was dead, well, that was hardly news. Either way, it didn't affect him. He'd read everything there was to read about the case between 2010 and 2014, when the media coverage had finally started to dry up. He still remembered the names of everyone involved, even those with only a minor role. Shannon Pidd, Nate Appleyard, Victor Sutar. Just like he remembered the car Christy Reville had owned in 2010, a red Toyota Camry. He just didn't care about any of that stuff today, and he hadn't cared 2 days ago either, when Rihanna Briggs had first summoned Sanders and him to Swallowtail. If it was work, then he didn't care about it. That was the rule.
How about if we find Melody alive?
Said Sanders.
Imagine that. We won't find her. She's not there. Yeah, you could be right. Still, she might not be there, but someone will be. You're in for a big surprise, bud.
Pretty used to like surprises. He didn't anymore.
What do you mean? Wait and see, OP. Wait and see.
I wake up with a gasp of shock. I try to open my eyes, but it doesn't work. Why not? Crying. Endless crying until the dark outside started to lift, which means I'm looking at the new day through swollen, narrow slits. Bright light streams in through the trailer windows. Sunny prison. I screamed myself hoarse last night. No one came, and I heard nothing. Either this trailer's in a secluded spot, or else he knew no one who heard me would care. The first seems more likely. He'd have taped my mouth shut otherwise. There's no way to tell what time it is. I'm starving, my bladder's so full it hurts, and the inside of my throat feels as if it's about to crack into hard pieces from thirst. When will he come? I can't wait much longer. It's not possible that he won't come back, is it? He left me alone overnight, but he must know I need to use the bathroom. Yesterday he offered to take me to the bathroom and I said no, and now I feel as if I'm going to burst. If I weren't so dehydrated, the bursting would have happened a while ago. I also need food. Water. Mainly water. If I could get to the tap, I'd never stop drinking. As it is, I can't bear to see it even. Looking at it, imagining the water it could produce, is torture. He wouldn't leave me to die. No, he wouldn't. He said he was sorry, and he knows you're pregnant. He found the ultrasound photo when he searched your bag. The man from the hotel room in the middle of the night, the one I should never have walked into. I try to focus on this new fact. Yesterday I wondered who had done this to me. I listed names in my head. I couldn't add his to the list because I didn't know it. I still don't. But now I know it's him. I decide to count this as a step forward. My eyes feel as if they'll fall out if I cry any more, so instead I try to think. It's not hard to work it out. If Rihanna hadn't sent me to that room by mistake, I wouldn't have seen Melody Chopper or heard her talk about Poggy. But I did. That's why this has happened to me. The man with Melody must have decided that the answer to the question, Cara Burrows, is she safe, was no. That has to mean there's hope. If I can convince him I won't say a word to anybody, or that I'll say a lot if he'd prefer me to, make sure the whole world knows I didn't see a girl who rubbed her head and mentioned by name the favourite toy of a murder victim. I'm just a poor, confused pregnant woman who doesn't know which way is up at the moment. If I show a willingness to cooperate, he might let me go. I can make him believe me, I know I can. He doesn't want to harm me, it was clear from his face, the way he spoke. He seemed nice. In the hotel room and yesterday in here, he seemed like a decent guy. So much so that I can hardly believe he's the one responsible for doing this to me. No, Cara, you're the one to blame. How could I have left the country and put an ocean between me and all the people I love? Space to think, time for myself. The idea of claiming now that I need these things makes me want to howl. All I need is my family. That's it. That's all I'll ever need. For the five of us to be together and safe. I don't believe in God or karma or anything like that, but I know with absolute certainty that if I'm being punished, it's not for walking into an already occupied hotel room. That was Rihanna's mistake, not mine. Mine was trying to pretend a 2-week luxury holiday was some kind of amazing, marriage-enhancing rescue plan. How could I be so selfish? All the things Patrick, Jess and Ollie said and did or didn't say and didn't do, all the things I thought mattered so much and wounded me so deeply, I don't care about any of them any more. I just want to be at home with my family. Somehow, this will happen. The man won't harm me. But he might take the easy way out and leave you to die like this, tied up on a sofa in a trailer. My stomach turns over at the idea, but I have to think through all the possibilities. That's the best strategy if I want to get out of here. I have to face it. If he can kidnap, he can kill. I hear the scrape of the key in the lock, and a big no fills my mind. I so desperately want him to come back, and now all I can think is that I'm not ready. I don't have a plan. I can't outmaneuver him. All I can do is beg, hope, pray. Anything. Whatever I have to do to get out of here, to get free.
Heidi Casafina hated New York, loathed the place. It wasn't the city's fault, she was aware of that. But, hard as she tried, she couldn't arrange for logic to affect the way she felt. Still, her time here was about to end, and she figured she ought to be grateful for that. It turned out that New York wasn't, after all, a trap she could never escape. All her bags were packed. As soon as today's ordeal was over, she'd head straight to the airport and be on her way back home to her parents in Indiana. Not particularly exciting, but it would do for now. Heidi had loved New York City from afar for most of her life, then made the move from Bloomington 3 years ago. Almost immediately upon arrival, she'd landed her dream job in television, or so she'd thought, working on a show that was as important as it was famous, Justice with Bonnie. Heidi had started at the bottom, low status, low paid drudge work, and she hadn't minded a bit. Bonnie had made it all feel so worthwhile. She'd taken Heidi out for drinks after her first day at work,
just the two of them, and said how thrilled she was to add Heidi to her loyal team. Heidi had been flattered by the attention. At the end of the evening, Bonnie had leaned over, looked her in the eye, and said,
"You, Heidi Casafina, are destined for great things. You might look like a Disney princess, and you may be only 23, but you're shrewd and passionate. You remind me of the young me. Stick around, and you'll rise through the ranks fast."
Soon enough, she made good on her promise. Heidi was an executive producer on the show within 6 months, and when a handful of her colleagues started to make their resentment apparent, Bonnie introduced a new rule. Anyone who so much as looked at Heidi the wrong way would be fired before they could open their mouths to defend themselves. Almost from day one, it was clear that Bonnie's wish and expectation was that she and Heidi would have regular girls' nights out, drinks and dinner after work, always Bonnie's treat. Regular meant 3 or 4 nights a week, whenever Bonnie's husband, Will, "My second husband, the first was a monster," she would add to every mention of him, "was out of town on business." Bonnie was fascinating and super smart. She came out with things no one else would dare say or have the imagination to think in the first place. Like her very own theory, PSAS, also known as First Find Theory. PSAS stood for Police Suspect Attachment Syndrome. Bonnie believed that when a serious crime was committed, instead of waiting however long it took for all the available evidence to be gathered before developing a theory, detectives tended to fixate on the first significant item of evidence, see who it pointed to, then form an obsessive attachment to the idea of that person as the perpetrator. It didn't matter if that was the only thing in the whole case pointing to that person, or if 3 weeks later there were 17 pieces of hard evidence indicating that someone else was guilty. All that mattered to some detectives, "too many, way too many," said Bonnie, was the narrative they'd created around that first significant find, to which they then clung desperately, sometimes fabricating or destroying evidence that contradicted their theory. As a result, Bonnie argued, it was more common than anyone realized for the first suspect in a case to be charged and convicted, irrespective of their guilt or innocence. She'd said to Heidi at least 20 times in their years of working together, "I'm a victim's rights advocate, Heidi. The accused innocent, in danger of losing their liberty forever, are as much victims of crime as the raped, the murdered, the defrauded. Don't forget that. All too often, detectives and attorneys unintentionally collude with criminals to ensure the safety and prosperity of the guilty, and that has to stop." The wording varied slightly, but it was pretty much the same speech every time. Then came part two of her spiel, also with only minor alterations for each telling. "Look at the Melody Chapa case, perfect example. Suspicion fell immediately on Christy Reville, and as a result, the red flag psycho alert behavior of Annette and Naldo Chapa around the disappearance of their daughter was determinedly ignored." Don't ever forget that, Heidi. She'd forgotten nothing her boss had said to her since the day they'd met. Bonnie was fascinating, even when spouting propaganda in praise of herself. When Heidi had realized that the regular after-work nights out meant she'd been officially appointed best friend as well as favorite colleague, she'd been thrilled. The problems had started when an attractive guy had moved into the apartment next door to Heidi's and they'd started dating. Heidi found herself wanting to spend more of her free time with Seth, but unable to contemplate saying so to Bonnie. Each time she tried to formulate the words in her mind, "We're going to have to change our routine. I can only see you 2 nights a week from now on." She was aware of exactly how impossible it would always be to speak them aloud to the person who needed to hear them. Bonnie, she had no doubt, would turn cold in a fraction of a second. Heidi had seen cold Bonnie eviscerating those who crossed her, and she had no wish to be on the receiving end of that. She'd lose her job for sure, and no flattering recommendation letter would be forthcoming. And so, instead of taking any steps to cut down her Bonnie time, Heidi had found herself explaining to Seth that hanging out with Bonnie after the show had aired was part of her job. He hadn't stuck around for long. After the breakup, Heidi didn't bother trying to date anyone else. She understood that she was trapped by the best job in the world and hated herself for not minding more. She couldn't bear to blame Bonnie for anything, but she allowed her grudge against New York City to grow and grow. The noise, the pollution, the rudeness, the snobbishness. She told herself she ought to be feeling happier this morning. She was finally going to be able to leave the city behind and start a new life, hopefully a life with some room for life in it, not only work. She was about to be fired, and she ought to be ecstatic. Instead, she was full of self-loathing. Bonnie would never forgive her. That was all she could think about. She'd been told to wait in the reception area like an outsider. Miss Casafina? The solemn-faced, not much older than teenage receptionist